Snapper. We've got just 7 more days until Friday the 13th, the end of the Snap Judgment fundraising campaign. And as of 2 minutes ago, we've crossed the halfway mark with over 2,600 Snappers raising their hands. And I'm asking 5,000 Snappers to make this happen so I can roll into the meeting with the man and say, looky here, blam, Snap Nation's got my back. So I'll make a deal with you, all right? I'm going to give you right now a brand new show, Stranger in a Strange Land, an hour of incredible stories. And I'll give you the very same magic lamp in my pocket right now with your very own genie. I'll give you the head bopping Snap mixtape. I'll even give you a virtual window into a Snap story meeting where you can see how this show gets made. Watch Anna Sussman and Joe Rosenberg duke it out. But now, Snappers, you got to give me something. Because Snap ain't free. You don't even want free stuff. You don't want to hear about the time I went to the laundromat, folded up my clothes, put them in the basket, and drove my black ass home. You don't even want to hear that. So support storytelling you do want to hear at snapjudgment.org. Pause this program. Pause it. Go to snapjudgment.org. Let the man know you want a piece of this. Be part of the movement that makes news next week when everybody finds out that over 5,000 people took ownership of their show. Be one of them. Deal? Snapjudgment.org. I felt it at places I should be most at ease, at family reunions, at my own backyard barbecues, at a dear friend's wedding. I felt it like something is off. Something strange, and I don't know if it's me or if it's them. Well, today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we're going to find out. Snap proudly presents Stranger in a Strange Land. Amazing stories from odd people and even odder circumstances. My name is Glenn Washington. Let's go crazy. Let's get nuts. Because you're listening. You're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, the first story on the Stranger in a Strange Land episode actually comes from a stranger in a strange land who discovers within that land a place that's even stranger still. Snap's Joe Rosenberg starts us off.
Gavin is an English teacher, and his story starts the way a lot of stories about English teachers start, with him getting on a plane to go teach English as a second language in Japan.
And as soon as I stepped off that plane, it was a rainy day, and it was humid, and all I had was like a suitcase, a futon, a pillow, and they told me it'd be 2 months before I got any sort of paycheck, and I just spent $5,000, and I was all right, now what?
Then there was the fact that he was a foreigner, which in Japan, and particularly in Osaka, the working class town where Gavin lived, was a big deal.
And like when I walked down the street, I was it. I was like the white guy in town. And you know, people would look at you and they're like, oh, does he know how to use this machine? Oh, okay, he knows how to put money on his card. Okay. It's like, can he get a Coke? Yeah, he knows how to do that. So there are times where it's just sort of like, everyone's just waiting for me to be the foreigner. And so at the end of 6 months, nothing really had come to pass. And I randomly ran into this American dude named TJ. And you're like, oh my God, hey, what's up? You know, and you're like, oh, thank God I can speak English to somebody. And we get to talking. And we talked about like the fact that my contract was ending. And he's like, let me show you this bar that I work at. And I'll get you a couple of drinks. And so I go there. And it totally felt out of place, but it was called like McTarnahan's, or, you know, it sounded like the most Mickey McIrish, you know, sort of like fake Irish BS. And I noticed that there's a table, and there are like, you know, little pictures of like foreign dudes on there. And then there are all these Japanese women who are in the line, like signing up, and they sort of like wave me past all those people at the table. And I'm all right. And so they tell me to sit down in the booth, and I'm like, you know, TJ, are we going to hang out? And he's like, it's cool. I'll be behind the bar. You just sit here, and there are going to be some people, and they're going to want to talk to you, and just, like, talk to them. I'm all in Japanese, because, like, I don't know Japanese that well. And he's like, no, it's cool. It's cool. Just talk to them. And so all these girls, three of them, sat down, and as soon as they did, someone came over and handed me a little tablet, and then they ordered their drinks, and they had some cigarettes, and I was just like, oh, okay, and I, like, grabbed a lighter on the table, and I, like, you know, light their cigarettes, and I'm like, do you smoke? I'm all, no, and that kind of made them feel a little bit weird, and so we kind of stare at each other, and, you know, minutes are just passing by, and it's, like, kind of terrifying, and there was a Canadian guy who was also in our apartment complex who had been brought over. And the whole time, I'm, like, making eyes at him in his booth. And I'm like, what's going on? And he's looking at me like, I don't know. Because he didn't know what was going on either. But they drank those drinks. More drinks were ordered as soon as they were finished. And eventually, we just got a little bit looser. Mainly by talking about Disney movies. And then after about an hour, they left. And then, like, TJ's all, okay, here's the deal. You're getting paid.
The bar was actually what was called a cabacura, or cabaret club. Most cabacura are effectively hostess bars. They cater to Japanese men who pay to spend time with young Japanese women. But this was a special type of cabacura. It was for Japanese women who wanted to spend time with young foreign men. Men like Gavin and TJ.
Yeah, in the business, what he did to me is called catching. And if you're going to be a catcher, when people start getting off of work, you stand at the corner of a train station or something, and these are the crazy dudes with the Final Fantasy VII haircuts, and they're all just like, oi, Beppin-san, oi de, you know, hey, girl, come on over here, and they're like catcalling, and you think, oh, they're just trying to get a date, and it's like, no, they're trying to either talk that girl into coming to a host bar so they can get paid, or they're trying to talk that girl into become a hostess herself so she can get paid. So I guess that's just what happened to me. And so at the end of the night, TJ whips out a little calculator on his iPad and hands over $350. And he's like, how would you like to continue to be a host here? And I'd never worked in the service industry, really. I mean, like, I think the closest I came was I worked at Noah's Bagels when I was a teenager or something. And so at the time, I thought, what is the appeal for these girls to, like, talk to me? Why do this weird, I don't know, masquerade of a fake romance, you know, just for an hour, for a rental, you know, like a boyfriend rental. I didn't understand that at all. But at the same time, I needed the money to eat, to stay there at least until April, to figure something out. And so eventually I started working 2 to 3 days a week at this cabacura. A typical night at a cabacura, I would be the bar back and I'd serve people drinks until someone would come in and look at my picture and then tell the dude at the door, all right, I want to sit down and I want to talk to this guy. And you greet them at the door, give them a big old hug. They love that because, like, normally people are just like, hey, a little head nod. That's all you get. And then you sit down at your booth, you cozy on up to them. I would pop out my 5-star cigarettes or something like that and I'd tap it out, put one in my mouth. And I put that on the table with my lighter that was like a Kumamon lighter. And it ended up being like a little advertisement for the cigarettes in the bar. And then we just start talking. It's lighthearted, sort of flirting. It's, oh, have you seen that movie? Did you think that guy's butt was cool? It was very cute. And then you're like, well, what are you doing later this week? You want to go? And you kind of tease him about like going out sometime.
Gavin's regular customers, the ones who really liked him, were called email clients. That's because he would give them a kind of secondary email, so they could text him at any time. But more to the point, he could text them.
And you just talk up your clients throughout the week, and just be like, what are you doing right now, girl? And they're just like, oh, I'm at work. And you're like, am I going to see you tonight? And then the more you do that, then you can get your picture on a wall, and you can have a little nickname for yourself. So I went by Kyoshin, which is like teacher, or teach.
What was your rate?
An hour with me would cost $300 to $500 to $600. So as soon as they sat down, there was always a running clock. And your job is to make them forget this is paid by the hour.
But although Gavin's time was valuable, he really wasn't. He only saw a small fraction of that money. So he had to work 2 other jobs just to make ends meet. Plus, maintaining that willing suspension of disbelief with the clients, that really took its toll. For example, he couldn't just be Gavin. He had to be Gavin the American. which is to say he had to be a cartoon version of what an American is like.
Oh my god, I hated singing Disney karaoke. I had to do that so much. You say things like dude a lot. They think that's very funny. You say oh my god and they really love it. And then you drink and you drink and you drink. That is the number one thing that you do. And it'd be rude if I didn't drink what they were drinking, which was usually white wine, which, man oh man, like it was just some trash. But if you're, you know, running a few tables in a row, you are drinking 15 drinks in 3 hours. And so you're like, hold on for a second. You flip a stopwatch setting on the tablet and you just go to the bathroom and vomit it all up. And then you psych yourself up again. You just be like, all right, pop a little bit of gum in your mouth, spit that out because you can't chew gum in front of the client. Walk back out there. And as soon as you see them, you're like, hey girl, oide, bepin sama, you know, and you try and do your thing again.
And if you're thinking that this routine isn't exactly sustainable, you'd be right. Most of the hosts more or less hated working there. They just couldn't handle the constant drinking, the smoking, the odd hours, the fakery. In fact, there was only one host who seemed to be able to handle it. The club's owner, a guy named Krishna.
Krishna was an awesome European dude, very tall, very blonde, and one of the most flirtatious men I've ever seen in my life. He could talk to anybody. It never seemed like it was like a switch he had to turn on. he would talk to a girl and he would do like this tilt of his head and within seconds she'd be laughing. You know, he kind of looked like the devil in some lights, but he was just like, he was a handsome devil. So at the end of the night, if no girl was coming to you, he'd usher some stuff because he would just talk to these girls at the bar and he's like, why don't you go talk to that guy? You know, he looks cute, right? And Krishna was a good guy. I mean, we were friends, but I'm just like, how come it's so goddamn easy for him? You know? Like, how does he do it?
Yeah, but, like, how did you do it? Like, when you flirted with these women, was it a switch that just flipped on for you where you adopt a facade and then secretly inside you're being very cynical and calculating? I mean, like, what were the feelings you would have when you started talking to this person across from you?
For me, like, instantly I felt bad. I felt bad for both of us. I felt bad that I was okay with getting paid for that. And then I felt just bad that they needed that. And the more I talked to these women, you know, eventually with some of your more regular clients, you start getting into some of the deeper conversations and these would be the office ladies and they'd be the ones who'd be super career oriented. And you're just like, why are you here? And they'd be like, well, you know, I dated a guy in high school for a little while and they were like 45 years old. And you're just like, what happened after that? And they'd be like, I had a career and I'm too busy.
Would you ever be a proposition to take things further? A date, anything like that?
I did this only twice. There was something called Kareshi Rental, which is like, you could rent a boyfriend. And you can walk around and go shopping. Oftentimes what we would do is we'd go to the river and make future plans in public. There'd be a cafe. And, you know, she'd tell me what she'd want, and you'd, like, walk up to the counter, and you'd just be like, don't worry, I'll get this for you. And you, like, order and stuff like that, and it's all comped. She pays for that kind of stuff ahead of time. She agrees to it. And then, like, she is paying by the hour, in addition to that, to be with you.
Even though you're saying, don't worry, I'll get this for you, it's actually just her money.
Yeah, absolutely nothing's real.
Pretty much the only authentic conversations Gavin ever had, at least on the clock, were with hostesses. In other words, the women who worked at the other Kabakura, and who would actually come in and pay Gavin to talk about their own problems, just like any other client.
They were my favorite clients. I didn't get a whole lot of them. But the ones I did, you know, they had real lives that seemed to be in some mode of panic.
It's also weird because she's actually paying to have a real conversation because she can't have a real conversation anywhere else. Unlike everyone else who's paying to have a fake conversation.
It's weird, but a lot of them couldn't tell their folks. A lot of them couldn't tell their friends. And they're talking about like, I've got nowhere to go. If I don't do this, there's no work. And especially once you get up into 35, there's no like old hostess club. And like, you have no idea what you're doing after this. One girl, this same guy kept following her home at least 3 times a week, and he would always stay a fair distance behind, and he would save up his money, and he would go and he would see her, and they would have these really weird conversations, she'd say, and then he would just leave the club, and he would just wait for her to be done, which would be hours, and then he would follow her, and she didn't know what to do about that.
What position does that put you in to do something about it, not do something about it?
You know, I never felt like I could rescue these people from their situation. because they kept that reticence to be real with an emotion. And like, I would never really know where they worked. You know, they would have like some name like Chica or something like that, you know, and that's not their name. And so I just felt absolutely impotent in the face of my ability to be a real gentleman, mm-hmm. which is essentially what I was being paid to do. But I couldn't actually like protect a woman. I couldn't actually be chivalrous. And they'd be like, yeah, well, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. I got to go. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. Yeah, I got to go too. And then you would leave and you would never see them again. And your head plays out all these scenarios. What happened? What happened to that lady? I don't know. And so it was the dead of winter. It was January. I had been in Japan for 8 months, and I get another one of these hostesses. First glance, she looked disinterested. I don't know. She had a look that just like, that girl is a boss. And she just, you know, kind of looked mean in a very attractive way. And she sits down and starts speaking perfect English. And then from the get-go, she's very decisive and just like, all right, let's talk. You know, and just like, this is in a way that like I have not experienced people talk for a long time. She would talk to me about, oh, I read this book and I had this teacher and how did you teach? And so I picked out a lesson that I, you know, a can't fail thing that I used to teach my freshmen. And she's like, that sounds like some boring, touchy-feely bullshit. Is that the kind of teacher you were? And just be like, that is the core of what I'm talking about, the power of words. She's like, are words powerful? I'm like, absolutely words are powerful. And it sounded like you were lazy when you did that. And she just challenged me on every single thing. So it was just maddening. It was maddening talking to this person. And it was sexy. Just to have opinions. And just be loud and be mean. Oh, and be mean. Just super judgmental about things. And it was just like, oh, thank God. And so eventually she was just like, look, I really like rock climbing. Do you want to come rock climbing with me sometime? And I'm like, I'm out of shape. But I do it.
And Gavin and the girl, they started seeing each other. They even got memberships at the same climbing gym. Plus, she loved to go hiking, so she was an outdoor partner. Something he didn't have in Japan until he met her. They didn't really know where the relationship was heading, but they understood one another. She was actually really good at hosting, a lot better than Gavin, but just like Gavin, she seemed stuck.
Like, she had a mind, and she should be in college, and it just seemed like she didn't belong there. And in a way, I think that was one of the things I connected with. But eventually, we were on some sort of a hike, and she mentioned on this hike that the reason why she had canceled coming over to my place. She was just like, oh yeah, the other night I didn't come over, I was actually with Krishna.
Krishna, the handsome devil, the one who could make any girl laugh with the turn of his head.
And she's like, I've got feelings for him. And in a way, I was just sort of like, him? Because I thought, you know, he was charming. I was never as good as he was at, like, just bullshitting people. But, it stung.
But it's, like, something weird about how, like, Krishna is really good at the fake world.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not supposed to be bested by him in the real world.
It's strange, but I think they got along a lot better because they were able to find that they were able to charm people in a much more natural tone than I was. And I think that attracted them to each other. It's just like, oh my God, we are both like these incredibly charismatic people.
She was very good at fake relationships in her hostess bar.
Oh yeah.
Krishna was very good at fake relationships in his host bar.
And then they made a real one.
Shortly after that, Gavin quit the hosting business. He moved back to the US. Later, he returned to Japan and checked in on his old friends.
And I went back to my climbing gym, and I was like, hey, you see those two? And everybody was like, no, we haven't seen them in a while. And I was just like, what happened to them? Like, we don't know. Did it say anything? No. That meant she didn't finish university in Japan, but they went somewhere. They were gone. And I remember one of the last things that we said to each other was, if you're still here in a year, I'm going to be bummed out. And it turns out we both weren't.
Big thanks to Gavin. Now today, Gavin is back home teaching English full-time. He says he still believes in the power of words. The original sound design for that piece was by Renzo Gorio, with additional music by Andrew Vickers. It was produced by Joe Rosenberg. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, in some parts of the world, investigative journalism can lead to accolades and respect. In other parts, you're just trying not to wake up with the fishes. When Snap Judgment, Stranger in a Strange Land episode continues, stay tuned.
Hey, this is Anna Sussman, and we really need your help. We want to keep finding and producing great stories every week. It's not easy, but we love doing it, and we really need your support. It'll be super quick and painless. All you have to do is go to snapjudgment.org, and you can make a donation. Thank you.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Stranger in a Strange Land episode. You know, sometimes the land is strange, but sometimes you're the strange one. Our next story takes place in West Africa. And please note, due to the nature of some of our heroes' exploits, sensitive listeners are advised. Snap Judgment.
A man and a woman sit side by side in a sparse waiting room in a clinic on the outskirts of Accra, Ghana. They're both visibly nervous. A doctor walks in. He asks the woman to follow him to the operating room. This tape is hard to hear because it's being recorded in secret.
Does he also carry the pregnancy? Please sit down.
The woman hesitates. She leaves the man she came with and follows the doctor. See, this is an underground abortion clinic, and this doctor is notorious for coercing his patients into having sex with him before the procedure.
I bore the ultimate responsibility of whatever was going to happen that day.
This is the man left in the waiting room.
If I gave the girl the chance to stay in the room with this doctor, the thing the doctor would have done is to either have sex the way he has it with the others, or if the girl was proving difficult, he was going to sedate her and have sex with her. My only source of consolation was the fact that there were armed security men waiting outside.
Hello? So he's in the room. Okay. Let's go. Where are you? Bring him here. You are under arrest.
The doctor was very confident because, hey, whatever happened between him and those girls was done under key and lock. Of course, he also didn't know that we had chronicled his events over the past months.
The police hold AK-47s, but the man who called in the attack is unarmed. He calmly takes the doctor's wrist, cuffs it to his own, and he leads him to the police car outside.
My name is Anas Arimiyawa Anas. I've been working as a journalist for the last 14 years.
And not just any journalist.
Courageous journalists like Anas, who risked his life to report the truth.
When he speaks in public, Anas always wears a mask. For these Ghanaian school children, he's a legend. This is some footage from a documentary about his work.
You know, usually when I travel, my face is fully covered, but for here it is half, because it is home. I'm sure some of you will get an opportunity to catch a little bit of my face. I see you are looking into my eyes. I don't know which story to start from. Which story should I start from?
Anas has done so many stories, and these kids know them all.
Should I do the abortion? You want to hear the abortion?
He's gone into psychiatric hospitals. He's met with crooked medicine men and mafiosos in hotel rooms.
My journalism is hinged on three principles: naming, shaming, and jailing. The purpose of my journalism is to make change in society. I don't write stories for people to sit in their bedrooms, cross their legs, and start reading and smiling. And I am saying, if the whole of the African continent had adopted this particular style of journalism 40 years ago, the continent would have moved forward better than it is today. I do not begrudge my friends in the West for disagreeing with me on my style. Why not? They have a strong judiciary, they have strong police force, they have strong everything, so that the journalist in the West doesn't have to suffer. By the time he finished writing the story, people are running after it.
Usually, criminals are brought to court and corrupt officials are fired because of Anas's reporting. One time, he reported a story called The Orphan's Home of Hell about the largest orphanage in Ghana.
When I still keep getting reports that things are getting worse in that orphanage, and whenever I'm driving around and I look at that orphanage, I feel, yeah, you had an opportunity. Maybe you should have embedded much more better for a much longer period to be able to sway the public opinion towards making a drastic change in that particular school.
This story haunted him. Nobody was charged in the orphanage as a result of his reporting, and Anas swore never to make the same mistake again. It was 1 year later when Anas got a tip from a school teacher about a religious sect.
She actually first contacted me on social media and wrote to me that there was a sect. Told me the children were made to fast for very long hours. The children were dehydrated and emaciated. She also told me about the various acts of sexual abuse being meted out to some of the young girls within the camp. What got me was the fact that all of the people in the camp believed that Jesus Christ was coming today. Honestly, the first thing that came to my mind was that, I mean, it's not just possible. In the 21st century, a sect that is preaching this kind of preaching, no.
It was the type of doomsday cult you hear about from time to time in the States. And this one had gone criminal.
And the sect had quite a good following. And if we allow this to happen, I may be getting up one morning with a Jimmy Jones situation and I would never have forgiven myself. I needed to gather a lot more evidence.
Anas got a hold of some of the members who had escaped. They told him that the church had started out in a flaw, but the leaders had moved the entire congregation, more than 50 people, to a secluded forest. There, they said, they were forced to farm cassava and other crops all day.
In fact, that's why the anti-human trafficking unit was involved in the discussion from day one. I decided to join the church and hear it from the horse's own mouth.
Anas traveled north. He left his car in the nearby village and started the hike up to the church.
Getting to the camp itself was a lush forested area. You see a lot of big green trees. And you see that the road gets narrower and narrower. It becomes a footpath. Then as you walk, you will see that place has been weeded. You will see pepper, onion, cassava, bits of everything planted. The church has three gates, and then you start seeing the houses.
All of the houses were mud with thatch roofs. The cookware was all made of clay. There was no plastic anywhere, and everyone that Anas saw was wearing white. It felt like stepping into another time.
So three of the elders were seated there in the middle of a wooden structure. So they asked me, what brought me here? So I told them that I believed in the fact that Jesus was coming tomorrow like they do. After they had listened to me carefully, then one of them got up. I was pretty worried because now I knew that was the decision time, and went for spent about 15 minutes. And then he called me and he said, but God himself had a plan for me. That's why I have come and I have discovered the truth. So they were prepared to worship with me.
Every day, Anas would walk a half an hour from the village and join the church in their two main activities, praying and farming.
You see, the good thing about the church is that if you are new, everybody is willing to teach you the doctrine. And so I use that opportunity to go closer to anybody who wanted to be close to me. I met Samuel within the first maybe 1 week of my stay.
Samuel was one of the younger elders. He was in his early 20s. He'd earned the title of elder because he was a long-standing church member, and his role was to teach, mobilize, and discipline the dozens of children at the camp.
I remember the children resisting him whenever he was trying to beat them up. But he always overpowered them and beat them even harder. There were instances that he used his hand to slap a few. Those were the bit older ones, but mostly it was cane. And he really canes them because you could see the marks on their body.
Anas gathered footage of these beatings and of other human rights abuses. He found children who were, in fact, underfed and overworked. And he secretly recorded interviews with 10, 11, and 12-year-old girls who were forced into relationships with old men.
So when I was about a month, 2 weeks, then I had filmed enough.
Anas handed over the evidence to his team, and the human trafficking unit started plans for a raid.
As I kept on living with the people in the church, there were things that I appreciated. For example, one time, there was a girl called Rebecca who was sick, and everybody who cooked in the morning went to the door and left food at the door. Getting to the afternoon, they brought water, and there was this old woman who went and bathed her. The old man brought herbs to cure her. As for the children of Rebecca, they were already being taken care of by another woman. I found this to be very beautiful. I mean, it was like when you are sick, it's not your problem, it's a community problem. And this is what we need in the world.
Anas started to see some of the individuals in the camp differently. Even Samuel, the elder who was in charge of the children.
Oh, he was very easily approachable. He was someone who would ask you a lot of questions about the world. Anything about city life, he was interested in knowing. Remember we spoke about television, and I was telling him, oh, look, there has been new films that have come up. So I was telling him about Jurassic Park and all that, and he seemed very, very interested. Telling him about the new models of cars that have come, the fact that some can self-drive, and he's like, whoa. I realized that this was a guy who has been brainwashed to the bone. In order to go to heaven, you ought to do the right things. And he believed strongly that the only way to keep these children to do the right thing was to beat them up. And his thing was beyond redemption. I didn't even know what to tell him to bring him back to the world. He was so gone far. It was a difficult time, really difficult, because you just, it's always a sigh, you know, when you are talking to someone and then you just keep quiet and you do, I don't even know what to say. How could you be believing this? The more you understand, the more you are able to analyze the gullibility of the people. And I was pretty certain if one morning the supreme leader put together some poison and told everybody to take it, I am telling you, everybody there was going to take it without asking a question. I decided to engage in a conversation with my prosecutor, very well respected legal luminary in Ghana. So I decided to get into her head and discuss with her whether there are softer charges that could be brought against these people.
This is his phone conversation with Principal State Attorney Evelyn Ama Kielsen.
Hello. Hello, Ama. It's the same.
Are you?
I've been looking at the charges, eh? I've been thinking, what's this particular case, looking at it, in exception of the human trafficking charges, what else do you think would be appropriate to charge the people with?
me, I think that the statue will not be your domain. It will be the domain of the agent.
So she said, I think that will not be in your domain. That will be in the domain of the Attorney General.
But in any case, I can show you.
I perfectly agree with you on that score. But you see, you also understand that when you get into a story, you have the feel of it.
But it was a tall order, because as I kept on flipping the notes and trying to bring her to understand what I was understanding, she was strict. She said we have to go according to the books.
This is not a typical human trafficking story, where the people have taken cash, they put the girl on the bed, sleep with. It's not that. These are right people, wrongly guided.
No, you see, I don't have a problem with that kind of thinking. I mean, there are so many churches. People teach people different things all the time.
You see, I do not have a problem with that kind of thinking. There are so many churches using that as defenses.
The bigger question still stands. Are you going to treat these people like you have always treated human traffickers? Can there be a more humane face to this?
There are other charges, but my problem is that it is not up to you to decide it.
Hello, are you there?
There are other charges, but my problem is it's not up to you to decide, Anas.
Anas tried one last time to appeal directly to the police force.
You come in and let's play the soft card till we get everybody out.
We don't do that.
They were also very clear with me that, hey, that's not yours. We've done your bit. Let us also do our bit.
But Anas was thinking of guys like Samuel.
You can catch him on video actually beating somebody. But is that all? Why is he beating the person? Under what circumstances did he beat the person? Did somebody tell him to beat the person? He might be perhaps a conspirator. Yes, that's also possible. I didn't wish to see a sledgehammer on them. I wished that the hammer on them would be much softer than it was.
But it was too late. Anas had started something he could not stop. Finally, after 3 months of living in the compound, it was time for the raid.
On that fateful day, of course, everything was planned, so we knew. So we were in early morning church. I had been communicating via text message with the head of the anti-human trafficking unit. The police were already on standby in a lot of buses. So they signaled me when they were 30 minutes away from the ground. We knelt down, we were praying, and then I sent the final signal. And that meant that within the next 5 minutes, they will be there. Now, I was counting in my head. And as soon as it was 5 minutes, they were there right on time.
Hey, down! On the
So I heard the noise. Police officer shouting, hey, what are you? Where are you? What are you guys doing there? And then I lifted my head. I saw that they had surrounded every part. All the men were armed and they came from different directions. And they started shouting, who are the elders? Who is the elder? Immediately when that happened, someone was very worried. I could see that fear instantly in him. The fear of the guns. They rallied all of us together, asked us to sit on the floor. We kept on asking, why? Why are you here to take us? Even me, I was asking, why? What's the problem? I pretended as if I didn't know what was happening. And then they put a handcuff on some elders, as well as me and some others. They were shocked. And I could see the shock in the face of the church elder. And the next thing he said was that the day of rapture has come and they are all going to heaven. The people who were moody, they told them, don't be moody. It is all God's arrangement that this should happen. Then again, you see somewhat clearly now calming down. And that we are going to heaven is all part of the design. I saw him going to pack his things and holding them on his shoulder. Samuel was holding some of the children in his hand and leading them to the bus. There was no resistance at all. The policemen were not gentle and that they were pushing them. They started breaking some of the ports, demolishing some of the buildings. Everybody was picked all out of the place. Samuel, Rebecca, all the elders. We're just on the verge of entering the bus when I saw the touch. But by the time we got into the bus, about 4 or 5 houses were already on fire. It was a difficult time. You learn from every story you do. You learn. That's what makes you a master of your game. We ought to know that anytime we pretend we know the story better than the one who lives there, we are only shooting ourselves in the foot. I saw the people looking back and some of them crying. Then all of a sudden they burst into a song and they started singing. All the songs they sang was about going to heaven. It was quite a sad moment.
What's the meaning of that song?
It's
not album. So they are going to heaven. Oh, okay. Then we have done well. We have raptured them very quick.
But of course, I knew we were not going to heaven. And that didn't mean it was a rapture.
A few months after the raid, Anas went to visit some of the children at their new school, where he was relieved to find they were flourishing. And Anas has not slowed down, no way. Since the story took place, he's gotten his law degree, and just this past September, he released footage of 34 Ghanaian judges and magistrates taking bribes. So far, 20 of them have been removed from office. To learn more about this remarkable journalist, check out Chameleon, produced by iSteel Films. We'll have a link to it and more of Anas's work on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design was by Renzel Gorio and was produced by Anna Adlerstein. Next up on Snap Judgment, the Stranger in a Strange Land episode, we've got the return of Jamie the Wolf, and it is magnificent. Stay tuned. Snappers, I told you, the pressure is on. Here's what's going to happen. In just 7 days, I'm going to talk to some people about the future of this show. And I do not want to be nervous. I want to be confident. I'm not going to hold my head down. I'm going to hold it up because I know the people who dig this show, who listen to it, who talk about it, who are listening to me right now, you. I know snappers are not going to leave me hanging. I know this, right? So go to snapjudgment.org right now. Be it $2, be it $2,000. Give what makes sense to you, because that's the only way this happens. And you're not going to leave a brother hanging, are you? Snapjudgment.org. Snapjudgment.org. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Stranger in a Strange Land episode. Now, you don't have to travel to West Africa or Japan to be estranged from the world around you. I've saved the very best seat in the house from a recent Snap Judgment live show, and we are so very proud because Jamie DeWolf returns to the Snap stage with a story about a very personal journey. Sensitive listeners and those with small children should be advised, this piece does traverse some dark territory. Snap Judgment, live.
She sent me her suicide note as a text message. All it said was, "I'm sorry it had to end this way. I know you'll understand." There was no warning, no waving red flags, Our last goodbye was a slurred, "I'll see you later" at a dive bar 2 weeks ago. And she weaved her way into the dark. She didn't show up at work for 2 days until her roommate found her face down in a bouquet of bile. The medics pumped her stomach clean of the 28 Vicodin in the cord of Jack and then strapped up under cameras for 48 hours. They're not sure how she survived. It was a miracle she didn't pray for. She wanted to go out quiet on her bed, her hands clasped across her chest. But pills don't let anyone die Sleeping Beauty. Your body can't stomach such an easy defeat. She woke up just long enough to dry heave hemorrhage over her fists on the floor, her face gone purple, blacked white, until she blacked out under strobe lights. All she wanted was silence, but she woke to screaming sirens and her heartbeat becoming a metronome out of a machine. They only give her one phone call. She calls me with her last quarters. She wants to hear from a mouth who's tasted a gun barrel. The one who's seen the mental hospital, not in the movies. I'm the only Houdini she knows who's ever talked his way out of a straitjacket. I don't blame her for fumbling for the off switch. Too many years, I looked at my wrist like books that needed to be opened to the last chapter. Until the night I skipped to the ending, took a broken razor, and tore my arms open like envelopes. Now they're resealed. Like a secret I was never supposed to read. She says she didn't know why she did it. Just that she wanted to go to sleep and never wake up again. I know there's more to that story, but I don't push it. Not when her ribcage is still wearing a paramedic's fingerprints. So I let the question hang in the air like an answer too hard to say. Anyone can force their way to the exit. The hard part is finding your way back. And right now, the only way out is down a hallway it takes 3 keys to unlock, through an orderly ready to protect your own tongue from your teeth. The hours she didn't ask for are spent watching the clock tick. She says this place makes her feel crazy. Then laughs for the first time in weeks. Before, she wanted to escape her own life. Now, she just wants to get the hell out of these green-painted walls and to fix whatever she has left. She says in here, you have to prove yourself sane. But the tranquilizers help. Turn your smile into a jigsaw puzzle. Make the answers come easy. To the doctor's questions to determine whether you're a short-time visitor or a long-time tenant. This is the exit interview. The soft interrogation where you go from patient to prisoner. The doctor will click his pen against his teeth as he writes down what to do with the future you didn't want to live through. She wants my advice, so I tell her, remember, everything you say is about to be held against you. Once you've taken your own life hostage, you have to be clever once you negotiate its release. Tell the doctor that night was a horrible accident, a mistake you've already learned from, that the police sirens in the emergency ward put everything in X-ray clarity again. Tell him answers you don't have to believe right now. Tell him, even though you unplugged the phone, that this is just a cry for help. Admit you're broken. Ask for the latest fix they got in the drawer. Ask for a hotline number and counseling hours. Ask for a pill prescription they'll never give you enough to overdose on. Whatever it takes to escape, until you can sign yourself out with a shaky hand. Look at your signature. Remember your kindergarten teacher. And the days it took to teach you each letter that made up your name. Get your wallet back. Stare at your flattened eyes in your driver's license picture. Take back your keys to a house that will still smell like the nights you gave up. When the hospital door is shut behind you, you'll debate whether the sun is rising like a guillotine or an opening curtain. Be careful who you call to come get you. Whoever picks you up is going to look at you like a ghost in their passenger seat. They'll tell you if you need anything, just a call. They'll check in on rotating shifts. Allow them their anger. You're a memorial no one was planning for. When you get home, watch how the world never waited. Watch TV knowing that these sitcoms would still play even if you weren't here to see them. Your phone's gonna ring. No, you have to answer it, otherwise they'll kick down the door again. A week later, you'll wake up knowing that your funeral would have been today. It's not that you failed at your final, you just asked the wrong question. I tell her, I look at my scars now as an answer that most people never live to see. Attempting suicide isn't a mistake. It's your own life slapping you awake. You hear that bird outside? You wouldn't have. Today's newspaper hitting your doorstep? You never would have seen it. Now you're a sequel to yourself. You were your own near-death experience. And that night, face down on the floor, was just prologue. So keep this new beginning simple. Light a cigarette. Start the coffee. Avoid looking in the mirror too long as you brush your teeth. It's gonna be hard to meet your own eyes for a while, but feel lucky that the mirror can still reflect you back.
Amazing, Jamie the Wolf. Prayer of the Show, Tourette's Without Regrets. Check it out if you get a chance. You'll likely see me there. And you can see the video of this stunning performance at Snap Judgment's Facebook page. The original score was by Alex Mandel, performed by Alex and the Snap players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. And if you want to tell your story, because we know you have a story to tell, Snap can help. Go to snapjudgment.org. Snapper, I love Jamie the Wolf's storytelling for so many reasons. But one is because he's not afraid to take us to dark places, places he's seen close up. And I love that we have a forum where he can go to the edge and look over. This is that forum. This is a special place. And once again, once more, you've reached the end of a Snap Judgment program. Think about that. This is in you, deep. These stories are your stories. So protect this space. Support storytelling that matters at snapjudgment.org. We've got just a few short days till Friday the 13th, till we rock the world and let them know that Snap Nation has spoken. Let them know. Be a part of this. Donate right now at snapjudgment.org. You've reached the end of the episode, but not the end of the snap. Know this, we've put three full snap specials never broadcast on the radio, including Miss Underestimated, The Student and the Teacher, The Storyteller Show, on our podcast. And if you want more snap, subscribe to the podcast right now on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Snap is produced by the greatest team to ever dance under the purple rain. Please give it up for the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, who often enjoys a nice breakfast of starfish and coffee, the artist formerly known as the Beatmaster, Pat Massidi Miller, Anna, Let's Go Crazy Sussman, Joe Rosenberg drives a little red Corvette, Nancy Lopez is much too fast, Davey needs a kind of love that's gonna last, Kim, she graduated in 1999, Eliza Smith, Leon, sign of the times, Morimoto, Renzo, Diamonds and Pearls, Gorio, Jasmine Aguilera knows exactly when doves cry. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could be working part-time at the Five and Dime for some dude named Mr. McGee who would get upset from time to time because you was a bit too leisurely, and you would still, even then, not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC. We'll be right back.